Hello, and thank you for joining this Quantum to Cosmos Festival presentation. My name is John Matlock, Director of External Relations and Outreach here at Perimeter Institute. Welcome to those of you here, and welcome to everybody joining us online from around the world. This lecture is presented by KPMG, and today's lecture in particular is sponsored by Primal Fusion. So I would like to thank both Primal Fusion, which I believe is well represented in our audience today, and KMG for making this event possible. Thank you for your support. Also, thanks to TVO, our presenting media partner at Q2C, for making all of this technology possible, that is bringing the event to you live online and making it available live on the agenda broadcasts every evening. Before we begin, I would like to ask those of you in the theater to kindly turn off your BlackBerries and personal devices. Those of you at home may want to share word of that this presentation is about to start with your colleagues and friends with a short email. And I would also like to make a reminder regarding the Q&A session. At the end of the presentation, there will be a Q&A. We'll have a microphone right down here on the stage floor for those of you who would like to make your way through the audience and come down. This will be a great opportunity to ask a short, concise question of Corey right away. Those of you online on TBO and Q2CFestival.com, just file your question on the blogs and they'll be forwarded to Jennifer Dodd here in the theater. It's now my pleasure to introduce Cory Doctorow. Mr. Doctorow is a science fiction author, activist, journalist, and blogger. He's the co-editor of the blog Boing Boing and the author of the best-selling novel, Little Brother. Next week, his new novel, Makers, will be released. He is the former European director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and co-founded the UK Open Rights Group. Born in Toronto, Canada, he now lives in London. He joins us right now to talk about the global copy fight. Please welcome Cory Doctorow.
Thank you. Cheers, thanks. So I'd like to start today by with a warning about a powerful group of anti-copyright activists who are attempting actively to destroy the book. These are pirates who have no respect for our property. They dress up their position in high-minded rhetoric about how they are the true defenders and inheritors of creativity, and they've sold this claim around the world, not just to the general public, but to regulators and even to lawmakers. They say that they want to preserve the way that it's always been with books, that they are conservative, and that their radical agenda is really just part of preserving the status quo. But what they really see is a future in which the electronic book market grows by leaps and bounds, and in which they get to sit at the middle of it, raking in the money. They claim that it's about ethics, but it's really about profit. I'm speaking, of course, of publishers' legal departments. We are the people of the book. We love our books. We fill our houses with books. We treasure the books that we inherit from our parents, and we relish the idea of passing our beloved books on to our children. We force worthy books on our friends, and we insist that they read them. We even feel a weird and possibly inappropriate kinship with people we see reading beloved books on public transit or airplanes. If anyone tried to take away our books, some government censor or a mad prude, we would defend them with everything we had. We know our tribespeople, the other people of the book, because they inhabit homes given over to books, walls lined with books, piled on the stairs beside the bed, even bathrooms filled with damp, swollen paperbacks. Our books are us. They are our outboard memory banks, and they contain our moral, intellectual, and imaginative influences, the things that made us the people that we are today. And copyright recognizes this. It says that once you buy a book, it belongs to you. It's yours to give away, to keep, to lend, to borrow, to inherit, to include in your estate. But the anti-copyright activists have no respect for our property. They say that when you buy an e-book or a digital audiobook, you are demoted from an owner to a licensor, from a reader to a user. These thieves deliver our electronic books and audiobooks wrapped in license agreements and proprietary technologies that might as well be designed to destroy the emotional bond between readers and books. These licenses can run to thousands of words, If you pick up your iPhone and buy an audiobook from the iTunes store with it, you agree to a 26,000-word license agreement. This license agreement may, in fact, be longer than the book that you're buying. The premise of a 26,000-word license agreement is forget copyright. Forget the law that was written by Parliament or Congress. From now on, we make the rules. These licenses are filled with unenforceable clauses, but they're backstopped by other clauses that say things like, if any of this license is found to be invalid, the remainder will stay in effect. The translation of this is, copyright is nonsense. The words printed on this page have no relationship to copyright. We have made a farcical wish list of abusive ways to extract money from you, and we haven't even bothered to stick to what we think a judge will allow us to do. And on top of those licenses, we have digital rights management technology, the so-called copy prevention or copy protection technology. Although, as a former systems administrator, I know that the way that you protect copyright is by making copies, not by preventing information is by making copies, not by preventing people from making copies. Now, digital rights management technology has never prevented someone from making a copy of a book without authorization. To the publishers who insist that this will someday be possible, I say, behold the typist. Digital rights management instead makes it illegal for someone to create a reader for an audiobook that competes with the one that the publisher has chosen to release to. It prevents someone from making a reader for the electronic book that the publisher has chosen to release under. If Borders or Chapters had a deal with IKEA to be the exclusive suppliers of reading chairs and shelves and light bulbs for our books and claimed the right to sue anyone who made a shelf or a chair or a light bulb that worked with our books, we'd laugh. And if they were serious, publishers would no doubt withdraw their wares from them, because it's not in the interest of writers, publishers, or the public for readers to be held hostage to mere distributors. Who, if they gain power, can use lock-in to dictate the terms the way that the iTunes store dictated terms to the record industry. After years of talking and writing and thinking about books, I came to an important realization. I love books. Not just reading or owning books, but I love the idea of books. I am deeply and sentimentally attached to them. And not just me, society as a whole has become attached to books. They've become a kind of symbol of everything that's noble and good around us. A burning book is a symbol of tyranny. A library is considered the pinnacle of civilization. I had a fiction editor once who explained to me that if you wanted to make a character sympathetic to the audience, just mention how much that character loved going to the local library, and immediately they would acquire this penumbra of virtue. That penumbra of virtue surrounds the book itself. When I worked at a bookstore, stripping books and returning their covers to the publisher for credit and destroying the rest of the book was physically painful. I can barely bring myself to recycle the phone book every year. And this is a fine place to be here in the 21st century. Publishers, after all, pay high-priced marketing people to design the experience of the book, the electronic experience of their sales and marketing efforts. That experience of consuming and reading and discussing. Which brings me to the second half of my realization. The most important part of the experience of the book is owning the book, knowing that your children can inherit it, knowing that it came from your parents, knowing it can be archived or lent or borrowed, knowing that it's part of a library's permanent collection, knowing that the magazines that you subscribe belong to you, even if you stop subscribing to them, that they can live in the attic to be discovered by your grandkids on a rainy day, having your books there like old friends following you from house to house for all your days and nights. This is a literally invaluable asset that publishing has, and yet they have set out to convince readers that they have no business treating their books as property, that we shouldn't get attached to our books, and the worst thing is they may, in fact, succeed. People keep showing me ebook readers that try to recreate the book experience, and they add these kind of cargo cult fetish elements like animations of pages turning over. But if you really want to recreate the important part of the ebook experience, the part that keeps people buying books for their whole lives, even books that they have no intention of reading, books that they just want to have on their shelves for comfort's sake, then you need to restore ownership to books. If I buy a book, it's mine. There is no mechanism, not even in the face of a court order, whereby a retailer can revoke a book from me. And yet today's ebook readers are being designed to allow for the revocation of books, to have books taken away from you even after you've brought them home. Amazon recently and famously got into trouble doing this with a copy of 1984, a rather ironic title choice. And afterwards, Amazon restored those books to their credit. They restored the books to people's hands, and they said, "We're very sorry, and we won't do it again unless we're ordered to by a court and have no choice." This is a rather unusual promise to have to make. No retailer has ever had to promise you that they wouldn't come to your house and take your books away unless they had no choice. That has never been a choice available to retailers. Designing an ebook reader so that it can do this is nuts. Anton Chekhov said that a gun on the mantelpiece in Act 1 will inevitably go off by Act 3. We shouldn't design books so that they can be revoked from their owners without their permission or knowledge. I'm a science fiction writer, so I go to science fiction movies in order to feel envious and bad about people who write science fiction movies because they make so much more money than science fiction book writers do. One thing that's a staple of the science fiction movie that always makes me crazy is the self-destruct button on the spaceship. We've all seen this. Someone is in the midst of some intense action and they reach over and accidentally hit the button that causes the spaceship to start counting down, inevitably in a kind of plummy British accent, this being reserved exclusively for self-destruct mechanisms. And it starts counting down, you know, they often sound like Margaret Thatcher after speech therapy, self-destruct in 10, 9, 8. And I look at that and I think, you know, I'm not an engineer, but wouldn't that be a better spaceship if it wasn't designed to occasionally explode? Not that it wouldn't explode, but designing it to explode, doesn't that mean that eventually it will probably explode? Doesn't designing a book so that it can be taken away from its owner without the owner's permission, without the owner's consent, without the owner's knowledge, doesn't that mean that someday that book will be taken away from a reader without their consent and without their knowledge? If I own an audiobook on CD, it's mine. I can rip it to any format, WMA, AAC, MP3, and play it on any player I own today or any player I buy tomorrow. And no DRM prohibits this, but you just try and find an audiobook that you buy digitally that comes with the same set of terms. We love our books because they belong to us. They are our intellectual outboard coprocessors and memory units, and we store in them our inspiration and our aspirations and our fantasies. Anyone who claims that readers can't or won't or shouldn't own books is bent on the destruction of the book, on publishing, and on authorship. And we have to stop them, and it's in our power to do so. The library of tomorrow needs to be better than the library of today, not worse. Its books should be not just as capable as books today, but more capable. We all know this. It's time that we stop pretending that these pirates are right. These people were all readers before they were publishers, before they were writers, before they were agents or salespeople or marketers. They are the people of the book, and it's time that they started acting like it and that we held them to account and insisted that they do that. We stand today on the brink of the realization of an age-old and important and noble human dream, universal access to all human knowledge. The cost of facts has crashed, gone from nearly infinity to zero. When I was a teenage boy, like many teenage boys, I fetishized books of forbidden knowledge, like The Anarchist Cookbook or Steal This Book, books that were filled with forbidden facts about how to do this or that or the other, how to get a restaurant meal for free or make a set of sandals out of an old tire or do ill-advised things with explosives in your backyard. And all of these things, the thing that made them valuable, that made them so interesting, was they were so hard to come by. But when I wrote a book that was intended to be subversive for young people, A Little Brother, my last book, I decided that rather than including individual facts, which after all you can find just by querying Google, I decided that I would write a book that was full of search terms, that was full of scenarios that described what you might do with technology, because right now what's expensive is finding out what you can do, not finding out how to do it once you know that it's possible. And so right now we inhabit a completely different world than the one that I inhabited as a young man. And yet we are also in the middle of a legal and social panic over the means of this dream, this free and perfect copying that's made it possible, that threatens to wreck it. Take, for example, the so-called Three Strikes proposal, which is in play all over the world. In France, it was called Hadopi. When it was first mooted at the United Nations, it was called Notice and Termination. It's been proposed as part of Canada's Bill C-61 copyright bill. It's part of another copyright treaty called the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, which I'll come to in more detail later. The Three Strikes proposal works like this. If you're accused three times of infringing copyright, accused without evidence, without a judge, without a chance to defend yourself or face your accusers, your ISP is obliged to disconnect you from the internet. In France, where they've just enacted this, they actually have a blacklist now of people who aren't allowed to be connected to the internet anymore. And any ISP who connects a person who's been blacklisted is liable to prosecution. And it's not just you who's disconnected from the internet, of course, because it's a rare person who owns an internet connection that's only used by one person. It's rather the entire household that shares that internet connection, a kind of collective punishment visited upon households without evidence, without due process, without a judicial oversight, merely on the say-so of rights holders. Now, I want you to consider for a moment all the things that we do with the internet, that we do with that network connection. So, health information. I'm the father of a young daughter. My daughter Posey is 20 months old, and when she was about 6 or 7 months old, I gave a talk in Manchester. I live in London, England. I gave a talk in Manchester. My wife and I and the baby got on the train, and she'd been a little under the weather, kind of flu-y, and we looked at her, and she was covered literally in tiny pink polka dots. Now, this was pretty worrisome for us because we live in Hackney in London, where they've listened to scare stories about vaccination, and there are a lot of parents who've irresponsibly refused to vaccinate their kids. So we have live measles in our neighborhood, and our daughter is too young to have her measles shot at that point. And when babies that small get measles, they die or they go blind or they suffer permanent disability. So there we were on the train, losing our minds. Really, just every parent's worst nightmare. But we had 3G modems on our laptops, and so we were able to visit the National Health Service's amazing database of things you don't need to worry about if you're a parent. And among the things that they can tell you at the NHS's database, which is available around the world, is when babies get sick, they break out in rashes, because it doesn't matter what they're sick with, their immune system goes crazy because they're still breaking it in. And so this and a million other pieces of health advice from the NHS and from other websites around the world have become critical to the way that we stay healthy now. It's a rare person who gets a diagnosis of something like cancer who doesn't immediately turn to Google to find out more. We don't just use it for that, though. We use it for things like social connectivity. I'm a Canadian, but I live abroad. I've been abroad for 10 years. Being an expatriate has never been easier. I stay in touch with my family. I stay in touch with my friends. I stay in touch with Canada by dint of the network. My parents video conference with my baby daughter from time to time. And many of you who are expatriates or immigrants or who have family abroad know just how the network has changed our relationship with our families and communities all over the world. Education. I mentor 3 students here at the University of Waterloo and another group of students at the Open University in Milton Keynes. I rarely visit either place, but my connection with them is all over the network. And many of you obviously have either pursued your education or continue to pursue your education over the network. And it's a rare student who could do her homework without access to the network. Political engagement. Some of you, I hope, were involved in the copyright consultation here in Canada, where over 10,000 Canadians filed their comments on copyright with the government. But not just civic engagement on that grand level. It's a rare local government that would allow you to do things like file a permit to put a shed on the back of your house using paper. Most of the time now you get those forms online and you fill them out online. You even submit them and get your response online. So to be cut off from the network is to be cut off from that kind of civic engagement as well. And on the very grand scale, the most recent American election was really a demonstration of the power of the internet for both sides, neither of whom could have fought their campaign as well as they did without access to the network, and neither of whose supporters could have been as connected to their candidates and as active without access to the network. Then, of course, there's employment. Is there anyone in this room who could do their job and earn their living without access to the internet? No one's got their hands up for those of you facing my way. And love. Many of us keep in touch with our loved ones. Some of us have fallen in love. My wife and I conducted a long-distance relationship for the first year when I was living in California and she was living in the United Kingdom. It's the single wire that delivers freedom of press, freedom of speech, and freedom of assembly. and yet we're proposing to terminate access to it on the basis of the say-so of a few self-interested rights holders, again, without judicial oversight, without any access to due process, without any of the things that we characterize as hallmarks of a democratic society, and not just for one person, for entire households. This is what's called a self-help measure. And self-help measures have been tried in copyright now for a very long time. It was in 1996 that the World Intellectual Property Organization, the UN agency that has the same relationship to bad copyright laws that Mordor has to evil, brought in the WIPO copyright treaties. And the WIPO copyright treaties, which Canada supposedly, depending on who you listen to, the US ambassador today excoriated Canada for not complying with the WIPO copyright treaties. But Canadian copyright experts like Michael Geist say that we're fine on that score. But the WIPO copyright treaties included many self-help measures, the most important of which is something called notice and takedown. And here's how notice and takedown works. If something is hosted on the web, somewhere visible on the internet, and you claim to be an aggrieved rights holder, you can write to the ISP, the internet service provider, the people who are hosting that. That might be Google on a service like Blogspot or YouTube, or a university server, or even your local ISP like Simpatico, who've given you some web space. You send a letter to them, and they're required to expeditiously remove that material from the internet, or they can be named as a party to an eventual copyright infringement suit, which means that, practically speaking, ISPs just take it down. In fact, by and large, ISPs don't even look at the letters. They just take the stuff down as soon as they get it, even if it doesn't pass the giggle test by a mile, because ISPs, you know, their margins are razor thin. The cost of consulting a lawyer to find out whether or not they should take your material down usually exceeds the total amount of revenue that they can expect to get from you over your life as their customer. So the stuff just vanishes like soap bubbles. So this streamlined process for making things disappear has been ripe for abuse, and unsurprisingly, it has been widely abused. Firstly, it's outsourced to thuggish firms who are very sloppy and who pay no penalty for making mistakes. So these firms do things like troll YouTube or Blogspot or other online hosted material. And if it just looks like it may be the copyrighted material of their clients, they send takedown notices. And they err on the side of sloppiness because they don't get penalized for making sloppy mistakes. So, for example, there's a professor at Stanford whose surname is Usher. Usher is also the name of a musician. Mr. Usher, Professor Usher, likes to put his lectures online as MP3s. There is a record label who takes any file that contains the word Usher and MP3 that's visible on the internet and fires off an automated, untouched by human hands lawyer letter to the ISP demanding that this material be taken down. That's magnified 1,000-fold all over the world. The people who do this are so sloppy that they often identify people who couldn't possibly be infringing as infringers. For example, there's a laser printer at a university that was accused of downloading an Indiana Jones movie. The group of people who've been accused of infringing includes dead people. There's a grandmother in Florida, a sweet little old lady, who was accused of downloading a bunch of gangster rap. People who don't own computers have been served with notices and threatened with lawsuits and so on. And it's been applied widely to non-infringing material. So there's a mom who recorded her adorable toddler dancing in her kitchen while Prince's Let's Go Crazy played in the background, about 30 seconds of video that she put on YouTube. This is classic fair dealing or fair use in the United States. And yet, Universal and Prince sent a takedown notice to YouTube, and then when they asked to have this material reinstated, the mom asked to have this material reinstated, they objected further, claiming that this really was copyright infringement, trying to essentially out-lawyer the other side. And it has been capriciously exercised. So Diebold is a company that until very recently made electronic voting machines. They were the largest electronic voting machine vendor in the world. Diebold had an employee who wrote a memo saying that their voting machines were being widely abused in elections in a way that really amounted to felony electoral fraud. And this memo leaked. It's not clear whether she leaked it or whether it leaked it onto the net through some other means. Now, Diebold didn't deny the accuracy of the memo. They didn't say, well, actually, no, our machines work very well, and they're never used in felony electoral fraud. Rather, what they said was that because the memo had been written by an employee, it was a work made for hire to which they own the copyright, and they began to fire off takedown notices to people who were hosting copies of this memo in the run-up to an American midterm election, when this memo would have been the kind of thing that you'd like to see. And it was only thanks to the extraordinary efforts of a group of very brave students at Swarthmore College that this stayed online. The way that the Digital Millennium Copyrights notice and takedown works is linking to something that's putatively infringing is not unlawful. Only the putatively infringing document is subject to takedown notices. So what the students did was they had a page that had a link to a place that you could read this document. Then they put up thousands of copies of the document on servers, but didn't link to them. And as soon as one of those servers got a takedown, they would change the link to the next server. So they essentially played a kind of brute force attack against Diebold's lawyers, and received in response thousands of takedowns from Diebold. Eventually, Diebold had to pay quite a penalty, $225,000 in penalties for having essentially willfully misused copyright. But they very nearly were able to keep this material out of the public eye during an electoral season when this was very important to know. And it's not just companies like Diebold that misuse this. Sometimes you get trolls like the Craigslist troll, this notorious guy who placed a sex ad on Craigslist in which he invited people to send naked photos of themselves to him, and then while pretending to be a woman, and then posted all their naked photos and all the email they sent online, and then did an appearance on Fox News in which he came across as, you might expect, kind of a creep. This appearance, clips from this appearance showed up online, surprisingly with the blessings of Fox News, who said, yeah, absolutely, this looks like fair use to us. Hardly a paragon of reasonability, but there you have it, right? Now, this guy claimed that he had a copyright interest in it, too. Again, this doesn't pass legal muster, but he was able to make it disappear from key websites during a period in which this was in the news. The Church of Scientology routinely uses notice and takedown and self-help measures to make their critics shut up. It's always easier to make things that are denigrating to you or that you disagree with disappear than to have to rebut them. And then in the case that I find most egregious, there was a student again at Swarthmore who maintained a piece of open source or free software called Flatlan. Now, before I tell you the story of Flatlan, I should ask a question. Is there anyone in this room who isn't a copyright infringer? Again, no one's hand is up. That's not surprising. I give this versions of this talk everywhere, and no one's hand ever goes up. There was one time it went up. I gave a talk to Disney's engineering group in Burbank, and there were some engineers there and some lawyers there. Now, none of the lawyers put their hands up because they understood the reality. A couple of the engineers kind of went, and the lawyers went, and they put their hands back down. Everyone's a copyright infringer, right? We are all of us copyright infringers, and these self-help measures, these streamlined measures, make us all liable to a kind of vindictive prosecution, because you can kind of pick out any person at random and go after them, and you know that you'll find something unlawful that they're doing. Well, this student at Swarthmore maintained this piece of software called Flatlan. Flatlan was a search engine. Google's a search engine. What Google does is it finds all the open web servers on the internet and indexes their contents. Flatlan finds all the open file servers on your local network and indexes their contents, just like Google, legal in exactly the same way. And it's used mostly on campuses. And on campuses, when you look at a local network, you find a lot of stuff. You find PowerPoints from lectures, you find audio from lectures, you find video from lectures. But being a campus, you find music that's copyrighted, you find movies that are copyrighted, you find ISOs of video games that are copyrighted, and so on. You find all this stuff. They went after this kid. Now, they didn't threaten him with a lawsuit for making a search engine, because, of course, making a search engine is legal. They went after this kid for being a copyright infringer. How did they know this kid was a copyright infringer? He was an American university student, so of course he was a copyright infringer. And as a condition of the settlement, they didn't just want his life savings, they wanted him to change majors. Right? They said, we don't want programmers like you in the field. Right? You have the wrong ideas about what kind of code to write. Now, this is the danger of these self-help measures, and this is the danger of expanding the scope of copyright to the point that we're all infringers, is that it makes any one of us liable to this kind of attack, and the only defense that we have in cases like that, because honestly, the legal penalties for this in the United States run from $150,000 to $250,000 per act of infringement. I mean, this kid was probably liable for, you know, sort of a quintillion dollars worth of copyright infringement because he's, you know, again, an American university student. He probably had, half a terabyte of music sitting there. And you're able, at that point, you have so much leverage over people that you can kind of get them to do anything. And the only defense he had was... we of us who thought that it was terrible made so much sort of vicious fun of them for doing it that they were embarrassed into dropping the demand. But I don't think that that's what we can really count on as a means of getting judgment. Widespread popular derision is a poor substitute for a sane law that can be enforced in a sane way. So self-help has been this invitation to vigilantism, and it's been an arrogation of the state's responsibility to due process. And yet, we're proposing to extend it from publication to access to the internet itself. And this, all this to be taken away without proof and without the chance to defend yourself and without any reason to believe that this will slow or stop copying. This is very important. These self-help measures have been around since 1996. And since 1996, copying has exploded. In fact, there's no reason to believe that copying will ever get harder than it is today. It's not like hard drives are suddenly become more expensive and bulkier and less capacious. It's not like people are going to get worse at using the internet or the internet's going to get more expensive and harder to get access to. It's not like libraries are going to stop training people who've been traditionally excluded from the internet to type Batman Returns BitTorrent into Google and figure out how to download a movie. From now on, copying just gets easier. If copying gets harder, it's probably like an indicator of something gravely wrong, like a nuclear war, right? And we'll have bigger problems than copying getting harder. Copying from here on in just gets easier. And infringers will have access to things like cryptography that they'll use to hide the fact that they're copying. So dedicated infringers will go on being dedicated infringers. But in addition to this, people who aren't dedicated infringers, who aren't encrypting their connections, will find everything that they do spied upon in the name of stopping copyright infringement. Indeed, Viacom, who's brought lawsuit against YouTube for allowing infringing videos on YouTube, has, in their claims, claimed that one of the things that Google has done wrong with its YouTube service is allowing people to mark some videos as private, only visible to their friends. Now, I do this all the time with the videos I put on Flickr because they're videos of my 20-month-old daughter that are intended for consumption by my family, not by the general public. Viacom says that having a feature that allows you to block access to your content to only a small group of people should be illegal because it stops their enforcement bots from seeing what you've uploaded in case it might be their copyrighted works. And so there's no reason to believe that this will stop infringement also because the group of people who are historic great infringers, young people who are time rich and cash poor, are notably non-respondent to penalties, right? This is what it means to be a young person, is to make poor guesses about the risks and rewards of the future. It's part of the state of adolescence. And moreover, young people have been copying and trading music for as long as it's been possible to do so. My entire adolescence would have been completely celibate if it wasn't for mixtapes. And, you know, I'm not the only one. I mean, I think we've all avidly copied music. My undergraduate students, when I was teaching at the University of Southern California, you know, being Los Angelinos, were all involved in the arts in some way. Most of them made music. One of them actually went on to start a record label. A lot of them were in bands. And they had a thing that they would do over a weekend. They would get together with their instruments and with amps and with beer and with their hard drives. And while they were playing music, they were also copying music by the terabyte. No amount of spying on the internet, no amount of self-help measures will stop this from happening. So we're all copyists, we're all liable to this kind of enforcement, but it's not going to give the entertainment industry what they say they want. And no one's proposing that the entertainment industry should have to be subject to this as well. So no one has said on a policy level that if Universal Music sends out 3 incorrect copyright notices, that we should take them off the internet. I mean, literally, go around to all the Universal offices with a great big set of bolt cutters and cut their networks off, and Universal can be the record label that does all of its business by post and fax. The reason we've never proposed this for Universal or any other media company is because we understand that this is the corporate death penalty. that knocking a company offline is the same as driving it into bankruptcy, just like knocking a person offline is the same as giving them the death penalty for their participation as a citizen in the information society. And there's no proportionality in a proposal like this. So the entertainment industry says that if you download MP3s or movies with the internet, then you're an internet abuser and we should take your internet away. But publishers have never been able to successfully push the idea that if you abuse the written word with a photocopier and infringe on copyright using a photocopier, that publishers get to come to your house and take away all your books and you're not allowed to read for a year. That this is so wildly disproportional that we can see that it's disproportional when we apply it outside the internet realm. But the internet is weird. It's different. We're not yet used to it. It's being proposed, as I said, on many different fronts, this three strikes policy. The one that's most important, I think, because it's one that Canada's been a very active participant in, is ACTA, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, which I mentioned earlier. ACTA grew out of the failure of copyright maximalists to get their agenda push through at the UN. So it used to be that they would go to the World Intellectual Property Organization and they would just get a rubber stamp on whatever it was that they wanted, no matter how weird it was. It would just come out of there as a treaty. But activists like representatives from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where I used to work, discovered WIPO and we started going there. We got certified as observer NGOs and we started showing up and writing down everything that they said and publishing it. And suddenly, with a little sunshine, all of us ground to a halt. And after a couple of years of this, most of their treaty making efforts just dissolved into ignominy. And so they left WIPO, they left the UN, they left places where activists were allowed to show up, and they reconvened in something called a plurilateral private negotiation. Plurilateral apparently means multilateral, but sounds cooler. Multilateral meaning that it's more than two countries. So a bunch of countries have gotten together, Canada, the United States, Singapore, Japan, the European Union, and a few other rich countries have gotten together in a private negotiation forum whose workings are completely opaque to the public to negotiate the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement. Well, what's in it? Well, we're not allowed to know because it's a secret. But we've seen a couple of things. One is we've seen leaked drafts of it because they can't keep a secret. And we've seen memos about it. The Obama administration was petitioned by activists under the Freedom of Information Act who said, we would like to see the treaty that you're negotiating. And the Obama administration responded with a no. They said, no, this is a matter of national security. But they would write a memo explaining what kind of stuff you could expect to find in it. And this is where we found out that the reason that they're doing it is because they can't get their agenda pushed through at the UN. They said, essentially the first paragraph of the memo said, the UN is no longer a suitable place because we can't get anything done there. So what's in the memo? Well, first of all, there's three strikes. In addition to three strikes, there's criminal sanctions for simple copyright infringement. So right now, simple copyright infringement, non-commercial copyright infringement is purely civil. You could pay a huge fine, but no one's going to jail for it. What they're proposing now is that simple copyright infringement should include jail time if it's asked for by either a public prosecutor or a private, someone who's bringing a private action. So it would enter the realm of the criminal, which means that kids would no longer be liable just for their life savings, but they could go to jail. Now, it's unlikely they'll be sending people to jail by the thousands, although we said that about whether they'd sue people by the thousands, and they surprised us all by suing 30,000 music downloaders in America. But I think it's unlikely that they'll send people to jail by the thousands. What I think is likely is that the Swarthmore Flatland story will be repeated again and again, but this time with far more leverage, because they can not only drive you into bankruptcy, but they can send you to jail. This is not a good use of our prisons, and it's, again, unlikely to deter infringement by the people who they're trying to stop, and it's just kind of a bad idea on its face. Now, in addition to this, there's a provision that would require ISPs to assist rights holders in wiretapping all of your communications over the net, so your email and your browsing habits and so on, would be subject to surveillance, mass surveillance, to stop you from infringing copyright. And disturbing for me, because I travel a lot, it would impose on member countries a duty to police hard drives and other media entering, crossing their borders. So suddenly they would have to search your laptop. And again, like the internet is more than a vehicle for delivering MP3s and Police Academy sequels, your laptop is more than a vehicle for carrying around MP3s and Police Academy sequels. Your laptop contains your whole digital life, your bank information, your health information, your private correspondence, all of this suddenly subject to scrutiny at the border to stop you from trafficking and infringing music and movies. So this has been, as I say, passed in France. It's under discussion in the UK, despite the fact that a recent poll showed that 80% of the British public rejects it. It's underway in the EU at another multilateral forum, and here it was part of the Bill C-61 provision as well. And then in addition to the ACTA stuff that's going on, there's also been a proposal to bring in legal spyware in Canada. I think this shocked a lot of us. This just happened last week. There was a bill under discussion in Parliament here to criminalize spyware and spamming. So it was to stop people from doing bad things to your computer in the name of advertising to you. And so it created all these stiff penalties for installing software on your computer without permission, for making it hard to delete that software, for installing software that spied on the files on your computer or deleted files on your computer or sent information about your computer to remote servers without your permission, and so on. And this sounds like a pretty good idea to me. I think all that stuff should be illegal. It's my computer. You got no business spying in it. But when the entertainment industry here got wind of that, they said, well, wait a second. This sounds an awful lot like digital rights management technology. After all, this is technology that lives on your computer and stops you from making copies and checks out what you're doing and intervenes if you're doing something naughty, and it's designed to be hard to uninstall and all the rest of it. So they went to Parliament last week, and they met on Monday to discuss it. I haven't heard how that committee meeting went. But last Friday, we all got word that this bill was being rewritten to include language that would explicitly allow all of those activities, installing software on your computer without your permission, making it hard to delete that software, allowing that software to inspect your files, to send information about your files to a remote party without your permission or knowledge, and to delete files from your computer without your consent, provided that it was being done in the name of enforcing copyright. So provided you had a good faith basis to believe that it was being done to enforce copyright, you could do all of those things to our computers. And we can remember that the last time a really pernicious bit of DRM crept into the wild, it was when Sony put a rootkit on 6 million of its CDs. This is malicious software used to hijack computers. That rootkit found itself not just into the hands of people's personal computers, but into 500,000 American military and government networks, into untold hospital networks, and so on. So when you start to combine that with a lawful regime for deleting files or moving files or spying on files, and you start to consider where this might slither into, it might be on the computer being used by your radiologist. It might be on the computer being used by your doctor. Might be on the computer being used by an air traffic controller. It might be on a computer being used by your lawyer with privileged information on it. This just seems like such an incredibly bad idea that it's shocking that our parliamentarians were even considering it. So that's Bill C-27, and it's something that you should all keep your eye on. Now, why does all this stuff take place in secret? Why were Bill C-60 under the Liberals and two drafts of Bill C-61 discussed entirely in private? Why is ACTA discussed in private? Why isn't this taking place in the public the way that other laws and bills are proposed in public? Well, the reason is that when you tell the public about it, they resoundingly say no. When the public found out what was going on at WIPO, they were outraged. When the public found out, was given the opportunity to speak out on Bill C-61, they said they didn't want it. When the public were polled in the UK about three strikes rule, they came out against it in great masses. So this stuff is only desired by industry insiders and by lawmakers, but not by the public. And so it doesn't get discussed in public forums. So this would be bad enough if all it threatened was this dream of universal access to all human knowledge. But it goes beyond universal access and free perfect copying. Free perfect copying and universal access are just what the internet does for a warm-up act. So it kind of looks from the outside like this is the most disruptive thing we can imagine. You know, free perfect copies all over the world instantaneously for nothing. 70 million times before breakfast. This seems like an incredibly disruptive thing, and it's hard to imagine that the internet could do something that's kind of even cooler, bigger, and weirder than that. But indeed, this is just the warm-up act for the internet. The real thing that the internet turns out to be good at is destroying transaction costs, destroying the cost of doing stuff together, destroying the cost of harnessing your labor to the labor of your peers and your colleagues and your fellow human beings to do more than one human being can, to be literally superhuman, that is to say, to transcend that which one human being can do on her own. It, it, it's it's something that's really represents the age-old dream of humanity, even older than the dream of universal access to human knowledge. And everything that we've ever done that transcends more than one person can do has had to tithe part of the energy to coordination, to doing stuff, to keeping everyone marching in the same direction, to keeping everyone on the same page, to making stuff happen. So the net destroys transaction costs. Think about this in the context of something like Wikipedia. Imagine what Wikipedia would be like without the internet, how you would accomplish Wikipedia. Imagine the trucks crisscrossing the world filled with filing cabinets being delivered to people's houses so they could see what had changed in Wikipedia, write in their corrections, have the trucks all shipped back to a central depot so they could be re-transcribed, put in filing cabinets, and shipped back out again. I mean, it is literally inconceivable. That kind of coordination can only take place with the internet in the middle of it. Or think of the GNU Linux operating system, which is running my phone and probably many of your computers, and certainly most of the servers you interact with when you send email or browse the web, probably the set-top box under your television, and maybe even the home automation system that's running the lights for your house. That operating system was built without a central coordinating body by people contributing either because they were being paid by a third party or because it scratched an itch that was important to them. This is a complex task on the same order as, say, building a skyscraper or doing the construction that's taking place outside here. But it's done without central coordination. Now, to build a skyscraper this way, the way you'd undertake it is you'd say, I have this big patch of dirt here. If you happen to have any structural steel or architectural drawings or office furniture or high-wear carpet or filing cabinets or welding rods or steel-toed boots or high-visibility vests, just bring them down to my construction site. In about 10 years, we'll have a skyscraper that we can all move into. You would probably not get much of a skyscraper, but you got an operating system that is a world beater out of it because the transaction costs of the network are so low that it makes it possible to do this kind of thing. Google. Well, Google allows us to collaborate in ways that are so easy that we don't even notice that we're doing it. You and I and anyone else who've ever made two links between a web page, a link between two web pages, have contributed to the underlying structure of the internet that Google picks apart when it tries to figure out what's important on the internet and what isn't. The main body of Google's search algorithm is built around citation analysis. They count how many links point at a web page and how many links point at the pages that are linking to that web page and so on, in the same way that, like, if you're applying for tenure, they'll count how many people have cited your papers and how widely cited those people are too. It's not a coincidence that Google was founded by a couple of grad students at Stanford who had citations on the brain. You know, I guess when all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So this kind of collaboration happens in ways that are so simple that we don't even know that we're doing it. Remember that before Google came along, the front runner for organizing the internet was Yahoo. Yahoo's plan for organizing the internet was to fill vast boiler rooms with librarians who would look at every page on the internet, decide what category of information it belonged into, and carefully insert it there. This turned out to be completely non-scalable, as we in technology say. So this is just the beginning. The things that are made possible by low-cost collaboration are weirder, more interesting, and more inspiring than anything in the world today. And that's just what's at stake in the copyright fight. It's not just books. It's not just movies. It's the future of human endeavor itself. So this is where I ask you to do something. So the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Electronic Frontiers Canada, nonprofit organizations that will happily take your money and turn it into incredible world-beating action. I can say that because they no longer employ me, so I get to sit back at a distance and admire what amazing stuff they do. I've never seen organizations work better with less to do more. And not just them, Creative Commons. Many of you are probably involved in Creative Commons in some way, either by releasing your work under Creative Commons licenses, and this makes a gigantic difference in policy circles. When the European Union was proposing a Europe-wide DRM, digital rights management system, that had as part of its goal to reduce the overall amount of creative work available without having to buy specialized equipment that would stop you from copying it, we were able to point to the fact that there were 250 million Creative Commons licensed works whose licenses explicitly prohibited that kind of action, and that all of those creators would be given short shrift by this European effort, and it fell apart on the back of that. It's incredible the moral authority that having people who are willing to share can bring, and especially for those of you who are involved here in the sciences. I mean, it's one thing for people in the arts to share or not to share. I happen to believe that people in the arts have a duty to share as well, because obviously we all stand on the shoulders of giants. But for those of you in the sciences, well, if you're not sharing, it's not science. It's alchemy. The difference between alchemy and science is whether you publish your results. For centuries, what passed for scientists were alchemists, and every alchemist found out for himself that drinking mercury was a bad idea. The act of publication, or as we call it in broader circles, the Enlightenment, made science possible. And if you're doing science without telling people what you're doing, then you're not doing science at all. So you can get involved through Creative Commons and releasing your works under Creative Commons licenses. You can get involved with CIPIC and with student organizations here on campus, like the Free Culture Society. We have the advantage of amazing collaboration technology. We have the advantage of understanding what the net is for. It's not just delivering better entertainment products to a faceless tube-feeding mass. It's for delivering the tools of change, the tools to change the world to everyone who has something that she wants to see changed. And that's really worth fighting for. So thank you. I'll take your questions now.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Anybody with a question here in the Theater of Ideas, please make your way out to the stairs here and then down to the front row. And
I'll remind you that a question is a short sentence ending in an interrogative.
And we'll start with Jennifer Todd of our festival team, who's taking the questions from online.
Yes, I have a question from Tatiana from Toronto. She wants to know, how do you see post-secondary education affected by the new copyright laws if they are passed? Will textbooks be completely out of the affordability range for students?
Well, I think that in tertiary education, universities and colleges, we have this amazing opportunity to run counter to that trend of ever more expensive textbooks. There are some textbook publishers, I should note, who really embraced the power of the net. O'Reilly being a great example of this, who rather than trying to like get university bookstores to stop accepting used books. If you can believe it, there are publishers who think that used books shouldn't be allowed. Used books are older than publishing, literally. O'Reilly has decided, okay, if you can't beat them, join them. They have this thing called Safari that allows profs to go in and handpick material that was published just this year from the entire realm of O'Reilly books and compose one-off individualized textbooks that are cheap print-on-demand books that are better than the textbook that was published last year. So they're rather than charging $50 for a textbook, they're charging $12. And that textbook is absolutely relevant in every page, and it was chosen by the prof. It's really good stuff, and it's very easy for profs to do. So that's great news. But running counter to this, also running counter to this trend of ever more expensive tertiary education materials is the wide availability of free and open tertiary education materials that are being produced by educators for educators and by students for students. I understand why university textbook publishers might object to this. I mean, if I were a university textbook publisher, I might say, well, I would prefer that professors not figure out how to get free materials into their students' hands. But I don't see why professors should want this. Professors, students, and universities don't benefit from high-cost textbooks. They benefit from lower-cost textbooks. And, you know, academic publishers are not charities. They're, you know, for-profit entities. And if you're publishing textbooks and the market doesn't need you anymore, there's not a moral duty to keep you around. I found when I was teaching post-secondary education that the variety of amazing materials on the net was staggering. I never really felt like I needed to turn to print sources. In fact, in most of the areas where I was teaching, print sources were hopelessly out of date and not interactive enough. There are a lot of university professors and scholars who rubbish Wikipedia as being insufficiently rigorous for university education, and they lament the fact that their students use it as a primary source, and I agree, it's a terrible primary source. But of course, every encyclopedia is a terrible primary source. If I had a student in my undergrad class who used Britannica as their primary source, I'd flunk them too. But what Wikipedia was amazing for was as a pedagogical tool. So what I did was I took my students and I said, every week I want you reading Wikipedia entries relevant to the material that we're studying. And I want you finding areas where there are citations needed or where there's discussion or dispute. And I want you to contribute to that on the discuss page and updating the Wikipedia pages where it's appropriate. And then every week we went through every student's edits through Wikipedia, and we were able to see how their understanding of the material reflected the broader debate that everyone who cared about the subject, who was participating on Wikipedia, felt about it. And moreover, when we were done, we had a better Wikipedia. So it was more accurate, not less. So rather than taking these students, I was at the University of Southern California, where these students were paying an unbelievable amount of money, $50,000 a year to attend, and rather taking them and assigning term papers to them that they didn't want to write, I didn't want to read, and no one would look at ever again when they were done, we participated in an actual scholarship so that when we were done, we had better scholarly materials than when we started. It was great. Yeah. Was that Utney Reader? I think that was Utney Reader. It was very nice of them. Yeah.
Just stand a little closer to the microphone. Thanks.
So I was just wondering what you have planned in the next 10 years.
What do I have planned in the next 10 years? So it's funny, because the 10-year horizon is a big one for me, because I have a 2-year-old daughter, a 20-month-old daughter. So we keep asking ourselves, like, what will we do for her, like, secondary education? Will we move to Canada? Will we stay in Britain and so on? My parents say yes. I think, like, in 10 years, what will her education be like? Maybe it'll be in, like, injection form. Like, how can I say in 10 years? I'm a science fiction writer, so I'm keenly aware of the hubris of trying to predict the future. I try to at least stick to, you know, just predicting the present. So I don't have any plans for 10 years from now, but I do have, like, about a year's plan out. And part of that is something that I just mentioned in a Publisher's Weekly article that some of you may have seen. I'm doing a new short story collection called With a Little Help that's endeavoring to get some facts on the ground about what you can do with open publishing models. There's been a lot of debate about whether open publishing models are good or bad and how much money you can bring in and whether writers should abandon traditional publishers. And so what I'm doing is I'm taking this collection of reprints, like my previous two short story collections, but I'm going to self-publish it using Lulu, which is a print-on-demand publisher, and I'm going to really push the boat out on the stuff that you can do with print-on-demand and self-publication. So it's coming out with 4 different covers, and there'll be limited edition covers through the year. It's also, of course, a free ebook that I'm soliciting donations from, and a free audiobook read aloud by all my voice actor friends. So Will Wheaton's doing one, and Leo Laporte's doing one, and Mary Robinette Kowal's doing one, and so on. And then that's also available on CD, and you can pay for that. But you can also have it for free under Creative Commons license. And then if you report a typo, I'll fix it in the next copy of the book that's printed and give you a little footnote at the bottom of the page. So kind of maybe you'll go out and buy another copy to see your name in print. And then there's 250 hand-bound special edition hardcovers with an SD card set into the cover with all the audio and all the text on it. And then the end papers for the books are unique paper ephemera submitted by writer friends of mine. So I have, like, Jay Lake's cancer diagnosis. I have some of Joe Haldeman's watercolors. I have Kathy Koja's hilarious grade 2 report card. And these are being bound in the originals in the end papers of the books. And they're also available as a free Flickr Creative Commons set. And those books are sort of $250 specialist artifacts. And then the really cool thing is all the finances for the book are publicly disclosed and bound in every month as a new appendix with a direct comparison to my last commercial traditional short story collection. So this may be, you know, not applicable to everyone, but at least it's applicable to me. It's an apples to apples comparison. What happens when I publish a book with a mainstream publisher versus doing all the stuff I can do? And the idea is to get some facts on the ground rather than just these kind of a priori assumptions. So that's kind of my next year. Beyond that horizon, I don't know. Eventually, I'm hoping my daughter will be potty trained and possibly sleeping in beyond 5 a.m. That would be really nice. Apart from that, not sure.
Well, it sounds really exciting. Best of luck with it.
Thank you.
Another question, sir. Just come right down on top of the microphone.
Yes. On Saturday, I saw Jerome Lanier talk. He endorsed Ted Nelson's Xanadu proposal. Yeah. And what Lanier liked about it was the idea that we would have all of the world's literature online, and whenever you read it, you would pay a micropayment. And the micropayment would basically provide the incentive for all of the works of literature to go online, which really isn't online right now. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm really skeptical of micropayments. Actually, I think the definitive essay on what's crazy about micropayments is Clay Shirky's essay on it. And he basically talks about the mental transaction costs of deciding whether reading this sentence is worth a penny or not. You know, we've had the opportunity to try micropayments in a variety of fora, and so far they've been a resounding failure. People just don't want to buy their newspapers by the sentence, as it turns out, or by the word, or by the paragraph, or even by the story. And where they've been offered in that way, they've just collapsed. The mental transaction cost of deciding whether you want to spend a nickel is more than a nickel, even if you can get the physical transaction cost down below it. I thought Xanadu was an amazing project. It was really interesting to watch. I was, like many of you, probably a Mondo 2000 subscriber and watching avidly as Ted Nelson talked about Xanadu, and I've seen him speak about it, and it's still an amazing dream. But Xanadu's got a lot of moving parts. Xanadu, unlike the web, is not characterized by the least possible agreement, where you have to do almost nothing to make a web server interoperate with a web client, and we all get to do it any way that we want. It's not small pieces loosely joined. The Xanadu project, for those of you who don't know, is a two-way hypertext system where whenever I make a link to you, it automatically has a link back to me, and every link that's ever followed has some kind of audit trail, and we can all see it, and the rights holder gets to see it, and so on. And the number of moving parts there, the number of lawyer hours required to negotiate that, exceeds the number of lawyer hours remaining between now and the heat death of the universe. It has so many moving parts that I just find it implausible. It's one of those things like, okay, first what we do is we get everyone to license everything. So all we have to do is figure out who everything belongs to, right? And from there, we can just go on to like writing up contracts that everyone can agree with. And then where those contracts are mutually incompatible, we'll just write a second set of agreements that sit on top of it that will inform people in some transparent way what they can and can't do. I mean, you know, I work with Creative Commons licenses that essentially have three clauses. And most people can't understand them, right? The number of clauses necessary to understand the agreements necessary to make a link between two pages in the Xanadu world seems to me that it would be wildly in excess of that. And I don't find it plausible as like a human, computer-human interface question. So I guess that's my view of it. I don't believe it.
All right, thank you.
Next question.
Annabella Newman. I'm on duty here. My question is, it's a common fact that internet is a tremendous storage, is like an encyclopedia of all this knowledge, modern technology and everything. And also it is storage of lots of evil things, and we would call this pollution. And my question is, do we have a power to control this?
Yeah, do we have the power to keep bad things off the internet? I guess that would be a pretty broad brief, evil pornography and hate speech and so on. And I think that as a practical matter, no. I mean, do we have the power to avoid it if we want to? Probably. But do we have the power to make it go away? I don't think so. I think that the only way that we could do that would create harms that exceeded the benefits. It would require us, for example, to give up on cryptography so that people could no longer communicate in private. It would require us to give up on the open network where anyone can build a website. You would have to have website licensing authorities that would determine what you could and could not put on the internet. It would essentially look a lot like AOL did before the advent of the web. And AOL was obliterated by the free and open internet and all the things that it made possible. I think that we get some good with the bad here, or bad with the good, rather. But I don't know that there's much that we can actually do to make it stop, except for traditional policing where people break the law. And of course, one of the things that the internet does is lower the transaction costs of policing as well. So finding bad guys using the internet is also something that we can do. I think that that's our best defense. It's unlikely that criminals would respect a prohibition on using technology in certain ways. So in other words, if we banned cryptography, it's unlikely that criminals would stop using it. When the American government tried to ban strong cryptography, in protest, people started to find the smallest ways that they could express cryptographic algorithms, strong cryptographic algorithms. It's so small that you can wear it on a t-shirt, you can have it tattooed on your arm. My friend Seth Schoen wrote a very wonderful series of haiku that expressed the DCSS cryptographic tool. So it's entirely possible to move this information around being detected, and what that means is that bad guys will continue to have access to it while good guys won't. And so I think that it's probably a mistake.
My second question is, it's common knowledge that professors, teachers, students use the internet knowledge for their lectures, reports, and etc. I was just wondering, you know, sometimes professors don't have time make a quote from which book it was taken, and what page, and what the verses, and so on. I was just wondering, where is the infringement?
So is a failure to cite an infringement? It can be, I guess, sometimes. The Golden Report, I think, on copyright, where they were copying big chunks of an American film lobby's internal materials without citation. I think a lot of people thought that looked like plagiarism. I guess if you're asking at what point would a judge say that there's an infringement?
I would like to know. What point would that be?
I guess the contours infringed of Canadian copyright law, fair dealing rules, are meant to be interpreted by judges who will have a look at it. It's what lawyers call fact intensive. So I can't give you a word count. At which point it becomes infringing to fail to make a citation. But the standards in most academic environments say that if you are directly quoting material, that you owe them a citation.
Thank you.
Not at all.
Next question, just speak right into the mic.
You were talking a little bit about releasing special editions of your book, and I found that really neat, the idea that you can make money off a free thing. And I know musicians make a lot of their money off live performances and such, where you can make money off something that you've given for free as information. I'm a programmer by trade. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to pay to watch me code live, as far as I know. And the CDs are, you know, no one pays special edition media. An SD card is pretty interchangeable. What kind of incentives do you think people who write software, which is one of the easiest things to copy, one of the first things that we started copying, that we can write, what incentives can we say, here, have this for free, but I need to eat?
I think you charge money for stuff that doesn't exist yet. I think that works really well in programming. We've gone from a model, initially the model for programming was, you pay me to write some code, and then you'll have the use of the code, to a brief period during which I wrote some code, and then I sold that code repeatedly. And now we're moving back into a model where you pay me to write some code, and then you get the code. And that's working really well. In fact, the biggest code shops in the world, like IBM and so on, are built around writing code on commission, right? Writing middleware, writing plugins, writing entire engines from the ground up, or using existing tools to make stuff better. Technology giveth and technology taketh away. There was a time when there was one business model, there was a time when there was another business model, and we're back in a time with yet a third business model. And it's not true that programming has vanished like a soap bubble just because it's very hard to charge money for code after you've written it, and so we have to write code. We have to charge for code before we wrote it. Instead, what's happened is the software industry has grown and grown and grown worldwide. A good parable would be the video game industry. So video games used to almost exclusively come in boxes on CDs, and all the money was in selling CDs in boxes. And the internet made it basically impossible to contain copies of those CDs once you'd ship the boxes. And they started to lose substantial revenue as a result. So they decided, okay, well, we need another business model. And game companies adapted. They created multiplayer games. And they created multiplayer games, first small multiplayer games like Quake, where you would have only five or six players, but there was a little bit of special sauce in the server side that they would provide that would cause people to buy licensed copies. And then when that started to collapse, they moved to massively multiplayer games, which are larger than the games industry has ever been before. And you have companies like Blizzard, who now have like 11, 12 million players worldwide off the back of something that's literally unpiratable, right? You can copy my WoW discs all you want. It won't let you play WoW. So they've figured out where to move the gate, where to move the exclusion point to a place where it makes sense, where people can't circumvent it naturally, and where they don't need extraordinary laws in order to keep people to continue to give them money. The music industry, as some musicians are actually making this transition, as you mentioned, back when vaudeville turned into the record industry and the radio industry. The people who were vaudeville performers were accustomed to making their living off the back of how good they were as performers. If they were really charismatic, they could make a great living, even if they weren't virtuosos. It didn't matter if you stood there like a statue and played your violin, it didn't matter how beautiful your playing was, no one wanted to see you do it on stage. When the radio and the record player came along, suddenly there was a new market for people who were virtuosos but not charismatics. And the charismatics didn't like this. They said, what do you mean I'm to go into a back room and be a mere clerk whose material is taken to his audience by an intermediary? I do something as old and holy as the first story told in front of the first fire. You have no right to tell me how to earn my living. And, you know, 70 years later, the recording artists who put all the charismatics out of business, the performers out of business, are saying, what do you mean I have to go be a performer? I'm not a trained monkey. I'm a white-collar worker. You know, I work in doors, and when I'm done, I slide my work under the door, and some bourgeois man of commerce takes it off to my audience. You have no right to tell me I have to go out on stage. You know, technology changes, right? And the way that you earn your living changes, too. And as a society, our priority should be to ensure that there's lots of code being written, not that there's lots of code being written in one way. And our priority should be to ensure that there's lots of music being made, not that there's lots of music being made in one way. So I guess that's my answer. I hope it answers your question.
It does. I just have one more quick follow-up, mm-hmm. which is, I'm pretty sure every employee at Blizzard has to sign a very long NDA saying you will not take the code that runs the servers and start your own version of it. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that kind of copyright?
Well, that's not really a copyright. That's an employment agreement. I mean, they would probably use copyright as part of that, but mostly what they get you is on breach of contract or breach of trade secret and so on. And, you know, I think that depending on the contours of that, it can be all right or it can be abusive. The place where I think becomes abusive is where employers maintain that they own all the work that you do, even when you go home. And they expect you to work, you know, 18-hour days and take your BlackBerry home and work from that. But that anything you do with it belongs to them. So I guess that's where it becomes abusive. I guess the answer is it depends. Jen, I think, has the last question. Is that right? No? Oh, okay.
No, I think that's it for questions.
All right.
Well,
thank you very much.
But the conversation will go on inside. I'd like to thank KPMG and Primal Fusion one last time for making this special event possible. The next event online and here at Perimeter Institute is The Agenda with Steve Paikin. That's live tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, so please tune in for that. Corey will also be on that session, and that's focused on robotics and the future of humanity. Don't forget to check out all the other Q2C events coming up for the next few days, as well as all the on-demand talks that you can now receive by tuning it in. Thanks to everyone here for coming out to Perimeter Institute today, for everybody online for joining us. The chapter's bookstore is now open at the back of the Perimeter Institute atrium for those of you here who would like to check out all the selections there.
They're sold out of my book.
But we are, it's true, we are sold out of Corey's book that just poured out the doors before you arrived. Please join me one last time in thanking Corey for today's presentation. Thank you. That was great. Thank you.
Can I just say briefly, if you wanted a book signed and they don't have them here for sale, my books are all freely downloadable. If you email me a copy of one of my books, I'll GPG sign it. I'll cryptographically sign it and send it back to you.